everyone. All right. Our first case for argument is 083473, Valero Energy versus United States. We have Jonathan F. and Jonathan C.
Yes.
Good morning, Jonathan F.
Good morning, Judge Roebner. May it please the court. Jonathan Franklin on behalf of the appellant Valero Energy Corporation. In rejecting Valero's claims of privilege as to documents requested by the IRS, the district court made two fundamental errors. First, it misinterpreted the scope of the tax shelter promotion exception to the tax practitioner privilege so as to abrogate the privilege for a vast array of individualized tax planning advice that is at the heart of the confidential relationship that Congress intended to protect. And second, the court erroneously held that certain documents were not subject to the privilege in the first place, even though the documents on their face revealed that they involved federal tax advice. Now, the second issue depends in large part on documents that have been submitted in camera and under seal and that can't be discussed specifically at this public hearing without destroying their privilege. For that reason, I will likely be focusing much of my presentation today on the first issue, but regardless of the amount of time that's spent on the arguments, I want to stress that each of them, in our view, independently and equally warrants reversal.
Could you just tell me what the current status of the administrative proceeding is? Is it on hold pending the resolution of this dispute?
My understanding is that it is on hold. Whether it's pending the resolution of this dispute, I'm not sure, but it has not really progressed very far. So
in other words, we don't know if it's pending the resolution of this dispute over the scope of the summons.
Well, I think it. Mr. Cohen might be able to give you more input on that, since they are the ones that are conducting the proceeding. I believe it may be that they are waiting to see what happens here, or it could be that it's just a normal administrative delay. But I think the important thing to note about that is that none of the underlying tax issues have been adjudicated. We're still in the early stages there. We have an administrative appeal that we believe is a valid one. The first issue depends on the interpretation of the tax shelter promotion exception, in which Congress carved out from the tax practitioner privilege a specific subset of communications, namely written communications in connection with the promotion of a corporation's participation in a tax shelter.
Now, I'm going to interrupt you just one more time, and because I have been wondering how long had Arthur Anderson been providing accounting services for Valero in 2002?
I believe Arthur Anderson had been providing Valero with accounting services, but this tax planning took place in large part in response to a merger that had been done between Valero and another corporation. That other corporation's tax advisor was Ernst & Young.
Yeah. See, well, here's what I was wondering. I was wondering whether it was hired with an eye to this particular tax minimization plan, or was it already providing general accounting services for Valero or Diamond Shamrock Ultramar?
I do not know specifically the answer to that. I believe they had provided to Valero, and in this particular, but I don't want to say that. I might be able to review the record again and get back to Your Honor on that one, but I know that what Arthur Anderson was doing in connection with this transaction was primarily reviewing plans that Ernst & Young had developed on their side of things. But what we do think is going on here is really a typical client-practitioner relationship in which the practitioner is advising the client on individual advice. And the question that we have here really before the court is how to interpret the word promotion. And the parties have advanced two different definitions of that term, and each of those definitions is in the standard dictionary. So the question and the task for this court is to determine which of those two definitions best comports with Congress's intent as manifested in the statutory scheme, its legislative history, and the purposes of the tax practitioner privilege.
And if that's true, though, why wouldn't a very broad definition of promote be appropriate here? If Congress was not happy with various tax shelter plans, programs, schemes, what have you. And this looks like a fairly complicated, I'll admit, but a deal that was just made to have paper losses.
Well, first of all, we would dispute that these losses pre-existed any of the tax planning that it went on here. These were real economic currency losses. They weren't manufactured by anyone. And again, that's the issue for the underlying proceeding. But to get to Your Honor's question.
It looks when you've got all these gyrations, money's going back and forth, that I understand it's legitimate to minimize your tax exposure, but if another person could look at it and say it's a tax shelter.
Well,
why wouldn't a broad definition of promote be, more to encourage? You go to a high school that wants to promote good moral values. They want to encourage moral values.
Right,
so
that's
a broad definition.
I think that one of the problems that we have here is that the definition of tax shelter itself is extraordinarily broad, and as the district court interpreted it, it encompasses any plan by any tax practitioner as to how any client might minimize their taxes. Now, that is a standard. That is sort of the definition of tax planning. And so if you adopt the broad definition of promote, what that means is that any time I go to a tax practitioner and ask him for advice, him or her, and he or she tells me you should take these steps in order to minimize your taxes. For example, in a hypothetical, it's not all that hypothetical for most people these days. If I suffered tax losses as a result of, or capital gains losses as a result of the stock's depreciation in the year 2008, I might go to my tax practitioner. He might tell me, hey, you should realize these losses in this year or take these steps in order to do that. Under the district court's interpretation of tax shelter promotion, any encouragement that tax advisor gives me is a promotion of a plan and the privilege is abrogated. The important thing to note here is that under our definition, which is the one that is expressly set forth in the legislative history, the IRS is not going to be hindered in its investigations. It's going to receive all of the non-privileged material, in this case more than 2,000 documents. It is going to have access to all of that, including all of the underlying facts. But and even under our definition of promotion, the tax practitioner privilege is still going to be narrower than the attorney-client privilege. The attorney-client privilege doesn't have this exception in it. What that means is that Valero could have gone to attorneys, tax lawyers, gotten exactly the same advice that the district court said was, in fact, privileged advice, and that would not be subject to the tax shelter promotion.
Doesn't the Internal Revenue Code define a tax shelter as something that can have the potential for tax avoidance or evasion?
Yeah, or evade, yes.
And that's pretty broad, isn't it? Tax avoidance?
Extremely broad, Your Honor. And that's
so
why.
Wasn't Congress intending to have that sort of broad effect for a concept like promotion?
Well, no. I think that BDO Seidman is instructive here. I think that the problem here is that you want to avoid the exception swallowing the rule. And because that the definition of tax shelter is so broad, the other terms in the tax shelter promotion exception have to be construed in a manner that doesn't allow the exception to swallow the rule. And I've just explained in certain circumstances that it does, in fact, swallow the rule for any tax planning that goes on between a practitioner and a client. Because any time that the practitioner suggests a plan, which the district court says anything that has steps to it, that's a tax shelter. Now, we dispute, of course, that there was anything illegitimate about this, but as Your Honor pointed out, tax avoidance, most tax avoidance, is entirely legitimate. In fact, I'll say this. I have that motivation every April 15th, and I think most taxpayers have the motivation to avoid getting hit with taxes that they don't have to pay. And that was Valero's motivation here. Now, this tax planning we submit was involved mostly with Canadian taxes, but that in fact was a motivation of any taxpayer. But to the extent there's any doubt as to what the language of the statute means, and there's, I guess, some doubt because we have two definitions, each of which is in the dictionary, the legislative history is an appropriate place to look. And there we have specific legislative history in which the report says that this is not going to disrupt routine tax planning activities because the promotion of tax shelters is not part of that activity. And the senator who was responsible for including that language made clear that that language and the statute itself was intended to, quote, target written promotional and solicitation materials used by the peddlers of corporate tax shelters. Now, we're not making this distinction up. This is something that was well known and is well known in the tax world. There were, in fact, there's a well-known distinction between the abusive practice of marketing tax shelter products, which some people refer to as the tax shelter industry, and the legitimate practice of tax practitioners advising their clients on how to minimize their taxes in an individualized setting.
Now, does it matter at all, do you think, that the statement you just quoted of Senator Max was just one senator's view that the exception is intended to apply narrowly to the written promotion of packaged tax shelters?
Well, it certainly was his view, but I think it has to be read in the context of the entire legislative history. In fact, if you read that debate...
Legislative history isn't very helpful.
Well, I think it's helpful in this case, Your Honor, but I realize that some differ on that. But he was explaining why the report language had included the statement that it did about routine tax planning advice. But even getting beyond that, Your Honors, I think what Congress was trying to get at was to target the abusive practice, the practice of folks going around peddling and marketing tax shelters. And what it was trying to do was to prevent those people from hiding behind a false wall of privilege. The BDO Seidman case is a good example of that, where they had cookie-cutter opinions, and this was a commonplace practice, fortunately less commonplace now. But these people would go around, firms and people would go around, selling tax shelters that they created. These were investment vehicles that they were trying to promote, market to folks to participate in, and those people would then have these cookie-cutter opinions that they would manufacture and send out to everybody, with the only difference being the name of the person. And I think Congress was clearly trying to get at that practice. But what it was also trying to do was to overrule the Arthur Young case and basically say that when you're a tax practitioner, you get the same privilege that attorneys get. So as I said before, if Valero had gone to tax attorneys for exactly this kind of advice, it would be privileged, and because there's no exception for this kind of practice. But here we have a situation where because the definition of tax shelter is so broad, it effectively swallows the rule. I would like to turn a bit just now to the second issue, if I might. I realize that it's difficult to discuss the issue because it depends on sealed documents, but I would just reiterate the example. If on page 19 of the district court's opinion, it held that certain documents were not subject to the privilege because they did not involve federal tax advice. The very first document that it lists on page 19 in that category is at page 155 of the sealed appendix, and that document says right on its face, quote, "The following potential federal tax issues have been reviewed." We submit that based on that, it is difficult for us to understand how the district court concluded that that document did not involve federal tax advice. And we have also, I wanted to make clear, we have not challenged every document that the district court held was not privileged. We have selected those documents on which we feel reasonable minds should not differ as to whether the district court erred. And
this is kind of a clumsy procedure, but what do you suggest is the right role that we should have in taking the ones that you are raising an objection to, that you claim a privilege was appropriate, and the judge, as Judge Kennelly, has reviewed them and says no privilege? Now, ordinarily we review with some deference determinations made by district judges in cases like this, but here I think we're going to have to look at these ourselves. So what do you suggest is our...
Well, we've offered two ways, Your Honor. The first thing is we believe you can look at those documents yourself and conclude on their face that they do involve protected federal tax advice. For example, document on that page 155, I think you can say that about, and that the district court clearly erred on that point. But to the extent the court has any question about what the content of these documents might be. And to the extent the district court had any questions, we submit the proper procedure should have been and should be now to remand so that we can provide further explanation as to issues that the district court may not have appreciated on first review.
Mr. Franklin, I'm a little sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm a little confused about that. Why didn't you provide that information before when you were asserting the privilege?
Because we had asserted the privilege successfully with regard to hundreds of documents in 2007 based on the same kinds of declarations of privilege log material. When we're going in, we have hundreds of documents, and we have submitted declarations and privilege logs that attested to the privilege of all of those documents. That sufficed in 2007. The district court found all of them to be privileged and protected. Then when we did the same procedure in 2008, the district court apparently shifted course a bit and found problems. We think that in the ordinary adversary circumstance, your adversary would come in and raise concerns that you would then rebut.
Well, why not go back with a motion to reconsider there before coming here?
We did. We did file a motion for reconsideration that was denied, and the district court, in some sharp language, told us, don't tell me anything new. And I mean, they say that a lot. So, I mean, we think that that was the proper procedure, particularly where on their face there's some question, we submit some serious question about what the district court found and how it found it. I think I would like to reserve the remaining of my time for the rebuttal.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Cohn. Yes.
I'm Jonathan Cohen, and I represent the United States here.
No, we do it that way here. We try and
kind of
have
balance.
People with the same names.
Kind of balanced.
Sometimes it's harder than others.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm used to it. I think that the case can be viewed as coming down to a dispute, obviously, over one word, promotion. But I think you also have to look at the word promote in its context. The statute talks about communications, written communications, that relate to a tax shelter. Any plan or arrangement, a significant purpose of which is avoidance or evasion of federal tax. Now, we've heard some talk about tax planning, which would not be, or tax advice, which would not fall within the scope of a tax shelter for most people because it is so common and so routine. Somebody comes in to see his accountant with a huge capital gain before the end of the year, and the accountant says, do you have any losses, as if anybody doesn't, and says, you better claim them now to at least offset your capital gain. That's hardly a tax shelter. If you were to push the envelope further, you could say that getting married is a tax shelter because you can take advantage of the lower joint return rates. If you want to push it even further,
it
having
can be a very
children.
Expensive tax shelter.
Oh, yeah. But even worse is having children because then you get a dependency deduction and medical expense deductions and things like that. So you can reduce your taxes by taking certain steps. But those aren't tax shelters to any rational person.
You see, Mr. Cohn, it seems you seem to be advocating an interpretation of the exception that essentially reads out the phrase the promotion of. How is the phrase the promotion of necessary at all under your interpretation of the statute?
If promotion means to encourage or to further participation, as opposed to Valero's interpretation of promotion, which is to sell a prepackaged tax shelter, it seems to me absolutely clear that Valero's interpretation is far too narrow and that ours is far more consistent both with the text and the purpose of the statute. Now, this peddling of prepackaged tax shelters is Senator Mack's term. As it happens, by the way, this court actually used the phrase. In Seidman 2, where the court says, as noted above, the eight potential indicators of fraud identified by the district court were, one, the marketing of prepackaged transactions by BDO. Now, that might be relevant from the standpoint of an abusive shelter, keeping in mind this is a very, very preliminary stage of this examination.
You know, the two cases that seem to address the tax shelter exception directly, BDO Seidman and Textron, they seem, I don't know, to me at any rate, to support Valero's proposed reading. I mean, neither of the cases, neither of those two cases resolves the precise issue that's presented here, but both use the phrase promoting a tax shelter to refer to the practice of essentially selling or marketing a tax shelter, not to individualize tax advice of the sort that was given here.
When we're talking about individual, well, first, there's absolutely no doubt that Textron supports Valero's reading. Textron's wrong.
Oh.
Yeah, it's as simple as that.
Well, you're not in Rhode Island, so you're all right.
Well, as a matter of fact, it wouldn't do Textron any good either, because Textron, having won the battle on that, lost the war because they'd waived the privilege. And the government's appeal in that case involved strictly work product, and not all the returns are in on that. But the fact remains that what you're dealing with here is the scope of the privilege also really turns on what kind of a, and this is from Seidman, foundation in fact has the IRS laid to show that the exception, and we have the burden, you so held in Seidman, rejecting the government's position, we have the burden of laying a foundation in fact that the exception applies. This appears to be a set of transactions, apparently 128 or so separate steps in this step plan, which, by the way, may have been used before by another Anderson client. It appears it has. So how much off-the-shelf or how much custom-tailored this was is a nice question that is open. We have nothing on the merits of what this shelter was, except that their loss was some 81 times larger in 2002, and their 987 loss, than it had been in the late 90s.
But of course, the Canadian dollar used to be such a boon.
No, my daughter went to college in Canada, and it saved me 75 cents on the dollar. There are currency losses. There are very, very complicated mechanisms for determining equity pools and how much loss you can get from foreign debt transactions, foreign currency transactions. All of this will have to be explored in horrible detail by the poor examining agent. But
Mr. Cohen, does it matter relative to the issues before us that this is an investigative summons as opposed to the ultimate tax determination?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
This
is not to accuse. This is simply to examine. If this case ever goes to litigation, and it may not. It may settle in appeals. It may end up in court. It may perhaps end up back in this court on the merits one way or the other. But the fact remains that what we have here is not some expansive reading that Valero urges where the exception will swallow the privilege. That's nice-sounding rhetoric. But in point of fact, that's really what it is. It's clear that while we do have a burden and we have an incredibly detailed, convincing affidavit, and on top of that, we have Judge Canales actually looking at the documents themselves in camera.
Now, in your brief, you suggest that subjective motivation is the test for whether the exception applies. So are you are you claiming that so long as the government, you know, is able to prove that the primary motivator in any given plan or transaction is minimizing tax liability, that the exception is triggered?
No. We have a burden, but it's only to show that a significant purpose, not primary, not principal. We have to lay a foundation, in fact, for being able to overcome the privilege, but it isn't that onerous a burden.
Well,
this is just a discovery burden at this point. This is not a fraud charge.
Well, assuming that we adopt your interpretation of 7525B, what limitation exists to ensure that the exception applies to plans that have, in your words, an improper purpose? Nothing in the exception itself imposes such a limit, and the broad definition of tax shelter reference is not expressly limited to plans with an improper purpose. The avoidance of income tax, you know, within lawful means. There's Mr. Franklin coming up here and admitting that he does it every April 15th.
So do I.
So do you.
Yeah. Worst thing that can happen in the world to a government tax lawyer is to argue a case on April 15th or 16th, trust me. But the fact remains that you, the federal judiciary, are the ultimate filters. When you read the declarations from the parties, when you examine the documents in camera as to whether this discovery burden has been satisfied. This is, again, the most preliminary of an investigation that has not led to any kind of determination on the merits. Is there enough there to meet our burden of a foundation in fact? Let's put it this way. A hunch probably won't do it. Certainty isn't necessary. And we're not talking about predominant purpose or dominant purpose or something like that. We are talking about a significant purpose is, it seems, a pretty reasonable standard for a court to apply. And keeping in mind, by the way, the government didn't win all of its summons requests in this case. In fact, we lost a bunch of them. And I would like for just a second to address Mr. Franklin's comments about, well, there's only 37, I think there's 23 documents that we haven't seen. We can't really comment on.
Before you do that, since both you and Valero offer competing and seemingly plausible definitions of the phrase with the promotion of, would you agree that the exception is ambiguous?
No, I don't think so. I think that if the term promotion can be ambiguous, to me connotes lack of clarity, I think that the idea was to use a significant purpose as a limitation on the whole reach of the exception. Promotion, because that certainly is capable of more than one meaning, but I don't think that in terms of its overall statutory context, even its context in the code, where it's much more comfortable with to further or to encourage, really renders that ambiguous to the point of becoming unhelpful.
But because, I mean, there's no controlling case law on the issue. The arguments on both sides seem to be, I mean, to me at any rate, plausible. Isn't this essentially sort of a judgment call? I mean, the most plausible interpretation may be something that's, you know, offered between Valero and the IRS.
Something between prepackaged tax shelters on the one hand and what we say is, okay, we've laid our foundation in fact, that there's a tax shelter here, and we have all of these communications, and we have a 128-step plan. If that isn't promotion, it's pretty hard to imagine what is. Somewhere in the middle is what Your Honor seems to be suggesting. But that's there are no regulations. This is not an administrative law kind of problem. So it's up to the judiciary, which means it's in your lap.
Ooh.
Wait till the merits.
Maybe we'll all be dead.
I'll take late return.
So are you done?
Yes, ma'am. I cannot answer your question to Mr. Franklin.
Would you mind? Because we want to record you.
I can't answer your question as to the current status of the examination.
Oh, I meant to ask you that.
As I said, we did lose as to a considerable number of documents. I don't know whether the exam is still ongoing, whether it's been put on some kind of hold, and if so, whether it's on hold to await what happens in this court, where I believe there's a total of 57 documents that are at issue. I think we're talking about the 23 that we haven't seen, and I believe there's 34 as to which they lost on the tax shelter exception.
Basically, this has been going on for 2.5 years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, justice is slow.
I'm sorry. My client works in that. But if I had to try to unscramble this omelet of this plan, when documents are being fed to me very reluctantly and very slowly, and I'm digging and digging, and my boss wants to know what kind of progress have I made, and then things start to leap out. You have this terribly complicated circular flow. You have this huge loss. You have the non-risk of loss. You have the countervailing statements that Valero's people send in saying, well, this was designed to substitute long-term debt for short-term debt. By the time we're just in the preliminary stages of trying to really get the investigation going, and all at once we're here in Chicago in the Seventh Circuit on a preliminary discovery dispute. Yep.
Okay.
I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohn. Okay, Mr. Franklin. How many minutes? 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is unfortunately in Your Honor's laps to determine what this means, the statute. And I submit one way to look at it is that it frankly is not going to hinder the IRS in this investigation or any other if they don't get materials that Congress directed are part of the tax practitioner privilege. But it will hurt all future tax planning if the court adopts the government's broad definition of promotion. Mr. Cohen says that, of course, the things that are individualized tax planning wouldn't be tax shelters because they're, quote, so common and so routine. But that's not what the statute says, Your Honor. The statute talks about any plan that has a significant tax avoidance purpose. And there is no limitation there, nor was there any limitation applied in this case based on how routine it is or how common it is. And I submit to you, even though the transactions that we're dealing with here are admittedly very complex, for corporations of Valero size, they are, in fact, the kind of routine tax planning that goes on all the time. So the problem we have here is you can take Mr. Cohen's word for it that these things are not tax shelters because they're, quote, common or routine, but that's not what the statute says, and that's not how the district court applied it in this case. And Mr. Cohen is correct that we have not gotten to the underlying allegations here. There's been no determination, nor can he make a determination, that any of these tax losses are illegitimate. As we stand here today, this is legitimate tax planning advice, and that's what we think will end up as. But the problem is if you adopt their definition of promotion, any time a tax practitioner encourages, which is their definition of promotion, a plan, which is anything that has steps, that has a, quote, significant purpose of tax avoidance, and I submit that most plans that are advanced by tax practitioners have the only motivation of tax avoidance. They're trying to help their clients avoid taxes that they would otherwise get hit with. So the danger here is establishing a precedent that is then going to be used, whether he says they are or not, it's going to be used to abrogate the privilege any time they can say that there's a significant tax avoidance purpose. I'd like to adjust one minor point. He said that there was some evidence that he referred to that this may have been used by other clients of Anderson. I think he's referring to the Ryder Declaration, which is cited in the brief. If one looks at the exhibit to the Ryder Declaration, which I think is Exhibit F, that is an email, and all it says in the email is there was a question being asked by one Anderson person to another as to whether a part of Valero's Canadian corporate structure might have been similar to another client's. It had nothing to do with promotion of tax shelters as we understand that term. And limiting this will, in fact, get at a practice that Congress wanted to get at. And it's the practice of marketing tax shelters. It's the practice that was engaged in by BDO Seidman. It's abusive, and that's what Congress intended to target. There are no further questions?
No. Well, thanks to both Mr. Franklin and Mr. Cohen, and the case will be